You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Russian warplanes have begun flying home from Syria after the surprise announcement that Moscow is to withdraw most of its forces. But is the move going to make it any easier to find a solution to the conflict in Syria now in its sixth year? I'll be discussing this with my guests today, Robert Fox and Phil Clark. We'll also be looking at the strengthening of Al-Qaeda in West Africa, and also how Cyprus is complicating the European Union's attempt to reach an agreement with Turkey that would stem the flow of refugees. Plus, a look ahead to today's Super Tuesday sequel in the US as five states hold primaries for November's presidential election. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor of the London Evening Standard, and Phil Clark from SOAS at the University of London. Welcome to you both. Russian warplanes have begun leaving Syria after yesterday's surprise announcement by President Vladimir Putin of the withdrawal of most of Russian forces there. It seems he timed his move to coincide with the resumption of peace talks in Geneva. In Geneva, the withdrawal has been called significant by the UN's Syria envoy, and some within the Syrian opposition are, believe it or not, hopeful. Hopeful, Phil Clark. There's a word we haven't used for a while in Syria. Can you understand why some people are vaguely, almost a little hopeful?
I guess it at least removes what one big military player from this really messy arena. So there might be a hope that the conflict sort of settles down into a slightly more manageable situation. But of course, Russia pulling out at this time leaves Assad and the Syrian army in a very, very strong position, the kind of position from which they can continue attacking various opposition groups and potentially continuing to attack civilians. So whether this ends up settling down the situation or simply empowering Assad to continue doing what he's been doing for the last couple of years, I think remains to be seen.
Robert Fox, I'm confused.
Me too.
When Putin first went into Syria, he said it was to attack ISIS. And 6 months on, I don't believe ISIS have been defeated in Syria. So was it actually really the reason he went into Syria?
No, but they have been attacking ISIS, and Russia will have to attack ISIS at some time. It's a big problem, particularly because of the Caucasian, the Caucasus, and Chechen angle. But to answer your question, why he went in, I think Phil would pray you an aid. It's because Assad was going down. They were losing against the moderate opposition plus the al-Nusra Front, as they had been before. They were losing at the time that the generals, without informing Assad, let off chemical weapons in the western suburbs, I think it was, of Damascus, because they were about to lose a whole chunk of the capital at that time. That's why Putin went in. It was absolutely desperate, and he saw Latakia and Tartus coming under threat. What he is demonstrating now, I think it is very, very acute. It's been driven by necessity. He does not want to get into a long ground war. And he does not want to get into a long ground war where his principal allies are the principal props of the Shia axis, namely Hezbollah and the al-Quds divisions, brigades. Very important that we are precise about this, of the Iranian army. Because the radical, moderate, whatever Muslim problem, as he would see it, that he has either side of his borders in Russia, again, the Caucasus in particular, are Sunni. And so I think it is cunning. Some people would say it was cynical. I agree with you. It's to give Stefan de Mistura a boost, and we could talk about that, I hope, in a minute. But boy, has he given the West, the Americans, the Brits and the French and the Germans a lesson on how to get in and how to get out. You will hear balderdash wall to wall on things like the BBC about exit strategies. The boy has done it. He's keeping his toehold there and he's saying to his allies, no, you get on with it.
And here's the other thing, Phil. As Putin has perhaps learned from America, wars cost money. And if you are an oil and gas dependent economy in an era where oil and gas ain't worth as much as they used to be, you don't want to hang around for long, do you?
No, not at all. That's clearly a huge part of the calculation here. I mean, I think from Putin's perspective, he must look at Syria and think, I've basically achieved my goals. I've propped up Assad's regime. I've done a little bit of targeting of ISIS. I've maintained control of the territory that I need to, and Russia can keep naval bases in place. The job is done, and this is a situation that could still escalate over the next few months. Better to get out now before it gets messy and this becomes even costlier. So, yeah, hard to argue with this strategy, even though it has completely caught the West off guard.
And I don't want to fight with Turkey. That's also what he is saying. That is a mess too far for him.
Indeed, it's interesting that for all Putin's sort of action man persona, he didn't announce the end of Russia's action in Syria by flying a helicopter or pretending to fly a helicopter onto an aircraft carrier and making a speech with mission accomplished. But in a sense, that is what he's saying, isn't it, to the Russian people, mission accomplished.
I think, though, that he is showing himself, I don't want to be sort of condescending, I would say quite a good, but I think a better military leader than he is given credit for. He is harboring or husbanding scarce resources. After the near debacle in Georgia, he has turned things around a lot, and there are things that are not going too well. Crimea, terrorism, so on, still not fully linked up. But the thing that does worry him, because it's all semi-autonomous, which means semi-out of control, is Ukraine. He's got to have enough to manage the whole picture. The interesting thing about Putin, which nobody too much in the screaming headlines has given him credit for, he is a strategist. He does see the Arctic, the Baltic, the Black Sea, the Eastern Mediterranean, Iraq and Syria, the Gulf and North Africa, they're all parts of a very, very big piece. And he has got to place his resources where he can, and he's got to look after them.
We'll come on to the peace talks in Geneva in a moment. But Phil, on that point from Robert, where, listing off all these parts of the world where Russia needs to think about what they're doing, there's another side to this story as well with Russia's involvement in Syria, isn't it? And to coin a phrase used by another demagogue at the moment, he wants to make Russia great again. And this has been part of his strategy, hasn't it?
Absolutely. There's the domestic arena where Putin loves to play the international game in order to curry favour with his own population, to be seen as a strong man and effective, which he needs to do because the Russian economy is in real strife at the moment. And he has a crucial international audience, particularly the West and more specifically NATO. He has, I think, used Syria remarkably to show Russia's clout, that it is an effective and strategic actor on the international stage. And now I'm sure we will see in Geneva that Russia plays an even stronger role in those peace talks than they have previously, because Putin can turn around and say, well, we did what we needed to do in Syria, but we've got out, and we've got out in a fairly respectful and hasty fashion. And you need us in these negotiations in Geneva. So he can shift seamlessly from the military to the diplomatic game now.
And then to turn, Robert, to those talks in Geneva, some within the Syrian opposition may be hopeful. And as you say, Stephane de Mistura, the UN envoy, may be sort of saying the right sort of things to help jolly things along. But actually, it's quite hard to see, what fundamentals have changed since the last time they tried to sit down and talk this through.
Well, I think as of Putin's announcement, quite a lot has changed. And I think it's very interesting how he and Lavrov and Kerry have decided they have got to back Stephane de Mistura at all costs. I know Stephane actually really quite well. I've known him since 1989. And he seems a classic of the best sort. Semi-aristocratic, Swedish-Italian, professional diplomat to his fingertips. And he seems always to mollify. I mean, the thing is, he could charm people like Hamid Karzai when he was in his most bloody-minded mood. And Stephane said over the weekend that there is no plan B. We hear that before, but he said, you've got to talk peace because there's nothing else that we can do. Kerry, Lavrov and Putin and, I guess, Obama have picked up on that, because what I read Putin as saying, yeah, you're an ally to Syria, but don't think all the conditions that you're playing around with, because they've been very difficult in these talks, the regime, the Damascus regime. They've been saying, really, we don't want to discuss the future of Assad, and I think that's now up for discussion. And they were trying to head off. One, they were trying to say that they didn't want the secular opposition at the table at all, and two, that they didn't want elections.
But do you think, sorry, just on this point,
it's all come back on the agenda again.
But Rob, do you think on that point, do you think the Russians are there as a not just backing up the Syrian regime, as some have accused them of before, but will actually be prepared to be critical inside a room of what the Syrian regime are doing?
I'm jolly sure. I'm jolly sure that they're fed up with some of the Assad clique because they want a deal. And taking on what Phil was saying, absolutely right. What Russia is trying to show is that it is a legitimate interlocutor. We've had all this trashing, you know, that it's a mafia state. Look at the stuff in the wake of the Litvinenko story. But one of the things that, you know, although he has beaten his chest like a sort of cartoon cutout Superman and say, I don't need these treaties, I don't need the INF, I don't need the strategic arms treaties, forget about that. What Putin really wants is a revival of the Founding Act, that in fact NATO and Russia and its friends can talk on equal terms. And I think he's getting quite close to that. I think he's done really well, and it's partly because of the detachment. It's funny how things go in pairs. Blair and Bush are very similar in terms of diplomatic tempo. Obama and Cameron, in their detachment, are very, very similar. I won't say, you know, a Trump and Boris Johnson going to be very similar, but it is.
Let's really
these pairings are very, very interesting. And what Putin has really pushed at is this sense of detachment. The quotes, I'm sorry, he is hostage to them, of some of the things that Obama has said about ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, as if it's a sort of a junior league basketball team, is patently absurd.
Okay, well,
that's why Putin has worked on that gap. And I think that he is getting to the position where he will have to be respected because he is a necessary interlocutor at these talks in Geneva.
Okay. Phil, are the talks in Geneva then essentially about the US and Russia striking a deal themselves and then trying to persuade the people that they are in some way backing or supporting to step into line?
That seems to be what's happening. And in fact, some of the reports today suggested there'd already been a huge amount of talk between Moscow and Washington. So I suspect we're going to see a very coherent front between the US and Russia in Geneva. The big issue, though, it will be what happens to Assad. Will there be a hard and fast stipulation by the US and Russia that Assad has to step down, that he has to go into exile in Iran or wherever? I suspect that, as the talks unfold, may continue to be a sticking point. My suspicion is that Russia would like to see a peaceful resolution to what's happening in Syria, but to still keep Assad in place. The US, I think, will push for Assad to go. That's not the issue now, but give it a week or two, and I suspect that one's going to rear its head.
In terms of what the US, Robert, can say to Russia, or what they can sort of offer Russia rather than offer Syria, is this then about saying, look, Tartus, your warm water port, you keep that. Latakia, you know, in the Med, you keep that. And also, you are, you know, you're here on the big boys' table with us. Is that the way that the Americans will be at least trying to think about it?
Oh, come on, this is so old-fashioned, so Cold War. One of the things that they must be really worried about, and I'd very much like to know what Phil thinks about this, it is the shifting positions as we go down the generations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And that's where you get a commonality of interest between Russia and the US. The swiveling and the newfound aggression of Saudi Arabia is very, very worrying indeed. And in fact, as has been flagged up, and a lot of us missed this by my colleague and friend Patrick Coburn in the Atlantic magazine interview of Obama, is how strong he was against Saudi Arabia. And in fact, he broke a given in American-Saudi relations in that he criticized the sect. He said, this is not good enough. What Wahhabism, I know you can't say Wahhabism is behind ISIL-Daesh, but it produces militant ideas which provide the seedbed for this kind of stuff. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to be a longtime ally, this has got to stop. That is a huge change for an American president to say that. And likewise, I think Russia is being very, very careful with what kind of Iran is emerging. Is it Soleimani and al-Quds, or is it the Rouhani group? There are very, very big things in play. And why I say, oh, come off the Cold War, yes, the Occidental press, but particularly the Anglo-Saxon press, sees the terminology in Cold War. It isn't. It is very regional.
Things are changing. But at the same time, we've just been talking about how, you know, this will be a deal struck between Kerry and Lavrov, and then everyone else will come on side.
Can we quickly say that? I think that that is absolutely vital, Steve. I think you're right to flag that, because what Putin and Lavrov realise, they've only got Kerry for about 6 or 7 months more. And almost any alternative to Kerry, whether Mrs. Clinton or Donald Trump become president, I just see it between those two, is not going to be as good. This is it is the odd couple. Well, actually, they get on very well, as we know personally. And that's where I see there's a big mo going, because they think that they've only got a few months to do this.
Okay. Phil, I want to get your view on the Saudi-Iran aspect of this. Because, yes, as Robert says, the whole relationship between the US and Saudi Arabia and Iran has changed dramatically over the last 2 or 3 years, and particularly since the nuclear deal was struck. Do you think that that is going to have any sort of consequence on these peace talks in particular, or is that more going to be an issue down the road?
No, I think I agree with Rob on this, that this is certainly more than just the US and Russia, that there is really a regional focus here. And this, I think, does show a real shift in international diplomacy in the last 10 or 15 years, that it's no longer about blocks of opinion being negotiated against one another. Suddenly now you have 5, 6, 7 major states involved, not just in this particular situation in Syria, but in many peace talks around the world. And it's a massive challenge for diplomats, because, yes, there is a short-term objective here about finding a peaceful solution to Syria. But there's a long-term game around regional relations, Saudi and Iran being two of the major players. And so that subtext will run all the way through Geneva. There will be a kind of a public focus on Syria, but these other relationships are also being negotiated in the background. So I think that's absolutely right to focus on that.
And this, Robert, is something that Barack Obama pointed out several years ago in 2009 during the talks here in London with the G20 after the financial crash. He talked about how this is the new world order. This is, you know, you can no longer have a situation where it's Churchill and FDR having a brandy and deciding how the world works. It is lots of nations that weren't around the table before talking about things. Now, back then, of course, he was talking about China and India and even South Africa and Brazil. And obviously, certain parts of that new world order have changed even since then. But do you think there is a realization amongst other senior policymakers, other than Obama and perhaps Kerry, that the world has changed in that way?
Well, I think there's a generational shift going on, and it's the kind of thing that Phil is engaged in. And, you know, and I look at a journalist like Gillian Tett of the FT. We have seen everything so much in terms of building blocks, because most of us, journalists and diplomats, are historians. We've gone to good schools. We have done history. History alone is not good enough. The way that people are talking about seriously as part of the toolbox, whether for a journalist or a policymaker, a diplomat, you know, a journeyman administrator, you've got to have things like serious applied social anthropology, economics to understand. Because one of the things that is so sad, I think, about Obama, terrific intelligence and terrific integrity in that intelligence, but actually he is the very best of an academic mind. He doesn't know how to instrumentalize it from a political point of view. Because what I think he understands, and I hope we get a lot more from him after he's left office about this, is that the building blocks are simply not the same. The world that I have looked at, I've spent 50 years writing about the wider Mediterranean area. One of the things that struck me when I did my biggest piece of research is the notion of the nation state as invented in North America or Western Europe, does not obtain by and large. And by the way, this is one of the colossal things that we are looking at across from Mesopotamia, from Syria, right going east. Because what is Syria going to be? Syria in 5-10 years' time is going to be nothing like a nation state that we would recognize it in Western Europe or North America. And I think that that's one of the big things that's going on behind the Geneva talks. And people like Staffan would see this too, is what on earth is this leading to?
Okay. Let's move on now to the US election, since we've been talking about Barack Obama, and as you've both suggested...
Coming back to Earth.
as you've both just sort of pointed out, he's not going to be around for that much longer. It's the... I think we're supposed to call it the second Super Tuesday later today. Five states are holding primary votes. Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Illinois, Missouri. If you're listening in those states, do go out and vote. Vote early, vote often, as I believe
Northern Ireland.
People are told in certain parts of the world.
Yeah.
Phil Clark, this is a big moment for both the Democratic race and the Republican race for different reasons. Let's talk about the Democratic race first, because if Hillary Clinton performs well today, we've said this before, but still, it would then pretty much all be over. And yet, as we saw last time in Michigan, where Bernie Sanders was, the poll said he had no chance whatsoever, he won. Were he to pull off a couple of victories again today, she'd be getting increasingly worried, wouldn't she?
I think so. And a lot of this is going to come down to complex mathematics, because it's not just about, obviously, how many states you can win, but how many delegates and, God help us, superdelegates you can win. So, you know, there's a whole lot of calculation that has to go on here. But my sense is that even if Clinton wins all five states today, I think this is still going to be a tight race. I don't think we've seen enough from her yet to think that after today she can build enough momentum to carry her all the way through till the end of the campaign. And Sanders seems to be remarkably adept at just continuing to chip away at her support. He's not going away. He's completely dogged. That said, I still think he'll pick up a couple of states today. I think Ohio in particular. His sort of call to the disenfranchised white working class in previous manufacturing heartland seems to really resonate. So I would expect him to pick Ohio up today. Obviously, it's a different story on the Republican side. I actually think this could be the knockout blow for Trump. I think if he cleans up today, that's him done.
Let's come on to the Republicans in a moment. But Robert Fox, just on the Clinton-Sanders battle here, one of the most convincing lines that Hillary Clinton's had is saying, I'm not a single issue candidate. Essentially saying that Bernie Sanders can only talk about banks and how we need a political revolution, and there's not much more than that. And yet, that single issue has exercised a huge amount of Democratic primary voters, hasn't it?
There's a lot of anger out there, and they're both tapping into it, both Trump and Sanders.
In different ways.
In different ways. But and that's why I think that come the day, and like, we can't avoid talking about him, I think that's why, because of the way Phil understands this much more, the algebra will turn out. I think that if Trump wins big, I think he's going to win the election. I think because there's something odd about what's happening.
When you say the election, as in
the general election.
Seriously?
Yeah. Because there's something odd, and my American friends, they're all trying to be... There's something very worrying about Hillary Clinton, that even if she picks up delegates, there's something that's saying blue collar won't go for her, she's a Marmite candidate, either you like her or you loathe her. And very little of this, whatever progress she's making, quite a bit of it, is not going to turn into votes turning out in November for her. And I think that this is quite an extraordinary situation. I was listening to her on the stump. She is very, very reasonable. But the trouble is that what she is doing, and this is why Trump and Sanders have got so much going for them, she's reinforcing the past. And people, the kind of people that Phil's been talking about, think that they're victims of the past.
Phil, when if you go back to 2002 and the French presidential elections, when Jean-Marie Le Pen shocked everyone and came second and got through to the second round ahead of Lionel Jospin and ran against Jacques Chirac, there were huge protests in France, huge big demonstrations, and the big banner that people on the left were waving was, rather a thief than a fascist, alluding to the fact that Jacques Chirac had had one or two run-ins with the police over money and various things. Do you think that there is that possibility in America that actually when it comes down to it, if it is Clinton versus Trump, there'll be a lot of people that say, OK, I don't like Hillary Clinton, but we cannot have that man as our president?
I think so. And I think I maybe disagree with Rob on this issue, although who can possibly guess in this campaign? Yeah, I mean, we've all been made fools thus far, haven't we? But I suspect that that will be the mood amongst a lot of voters. Better the devil you know. And many people do see Hillary Clinton as the devil. I think another factor that may play into this is the real fear, even amongst the Republican establishment, about a Trump presidency. Mm. So one of the things that Trump will also have to battle, if in fact he does win the nomination, is that he may not get the support from his own party that he would really need to try and beat Clinton. So he's going to have a job trying to get the electorate on side, but he's also got to get his own party on side.
Because this is the other thing.
He's insulted roundly. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And then this is the thing, is Robert, you see, you know, Marco Rubio last week talking about Donald Trump, and he was asked again, you know, you said before you'll support the Republican nominee. Can you still do it? And the pain on his face as he was asked that question said, I'd like to, but it's getting harder and harder every day. And there are potentially millions of moderate Republicans who are facing exactly that dilemma, aren't there?
Yes. And he's shown signs of it already, but Trump has really got to change his act now. If he wins big today, he's really got to sound like a grown-up human
being.
Yeah,
but we can't have that. I mean, then surely this becomes...
But he's started doing it. Of course.
He can try. But then this has to be a media watchdog thing about we can't just simply sit here and go, oh, well, look, he's tacked to the centre. He's got more moderate. He's still incited violence. He's offered to pay legal fees of people who've punched people.
Thing that Justin Webb of the BBC, who knows America very, very well, did the interview with the lady that built Trump Tower that he's praised and bigged up. And she said, no, I could not possibly vote for Donald Trump to be president. Temperamentally, which I think is a killer for a lady manager to say he is just not suited to it. And one of the things that she said, which I found fascinating, is that he just doesn't have the patience and the concentration span to do it. Boy, that is really very, very worrying. The character assassination that's going to go on in a Trump-Clinton contest is going to be amazing.
And also, Phil, there's a very interesting advert that was put out today, which was female voters reading out the words of Donald Trump talking about women. All real words that Donald Trump has said, mainly in the past year, words which I think, although we're not under any sort of Ofcom rules, I can't really repeat right now. What was interesting, though, Phil, was that advert, not a Democratic advert, not from the Clinton campaign, it was by a Republican group.
Yeah, the fear within the Republican camp is enormous. And you cannot underestimate the power of the female vote in the US. And we saw that both times that Obama was elected. Each time he increased the female vote, he spent an enormous amount of time campaigning very directly to the needs and the concerns of that constituency. And that is now a big part of US election politics, is you can't just appeal to what you consider to be the broad base of your party any longer. You have to pick out ethnic minority groups. You have to appeal to particular gender perspectives, and these sorts of things I think will matter. I think it will be Trump's Achilles heel the further this goes on.
And that's the other thing, isn't it, Robert, that Donald Trump has to win something like 70% of the white male vote to have any chance whatsoever, because already Republicans were struggling to win Hispanic votes.
Yes.
He's not necessarily the candidate to boost that. You can't imagine him winning many African-American votes either.
Yeah. No, that's the point. There is a contrast. There's, you know, he's by no means redneck right wing, but a conservative commentator like David Brooks wrote a wonderful piece about Obama the other day. And the interesting thing is, with all this crude rhetoric that you're getting from Trump, I mean, look at how rare the occasions on which Obama really has lost his temper in public. The man is gracious. He's gracious in demeanor and he's gracious in his language, which is a huge contrast, and it will become stronger and stronger and stronger as he lays out his final legacy and will talk about the world again. Indeed. In the way that he came in.
I'm
and afraid. I think the Clintons are smart enough to see that.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Fox, Phil Clark, thank you both very much indeed. We didn't have a chance to talk about Al-Qaeda in Africa or Cyprus, but never mind. Maybe tomorrow. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mary Giusti and Charlie Young. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Guy Lutz is here next. Then it's Section D with Henry Rhys Sheridan. Michael Daly also later. Midori House back same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.